Well, good evening, everybody. Hope you're doing well. It's the Stefan Bottyhead. Welcome to your Friday Night Live. And are you ready to have your mind blown? Like an expert? Are you ready? You know, I don't know how often you get your mind blown by this show. I know I get my mind blown by this show on a fairly regular basis. Which means certainly several times a week, which is a good schedule for getting blown, I think. So, I have a thought. I was chatting about this with my daughter today about how morality leads to materialism, about how morality leads to atheism, about how morality leads to subjectivism and relativism and mammalianism, which is where you just talk about nonsense, Dawkins-based reciprocal altruism, Alice Sam Harris, and don't ever get to moral principles that can last and be universalized. So, a great revolution of Christianity, of course, was universal morality. That was the big thing, the big deal with Christianity. Came along and said, stop being so tribal, everyone. Let's have universal morals. Now, universal morals produces such a great outcome because universal morals involves the end of slavery and the lack of, you know, end to some degree of the subjugation of women and so on, minimal government, equality before the rule of law. So, once universalism shows its power, universalism in morality leads to universalism in science, right? Because science is when you overcome the superstition of the imaginary coincidences of life and you actually start to examine principles of physics without the subjectivism of superstition. So then what happens is you end up with the universal laws. And of course, as I think Tom Woods was very kind and keen to instruct me on, a lot of the early scientists were highly religious men who said that, I think the basic idea was something like this. Well, of course there are universal, perfect physical laws because God created them. And how on earth could God show you who the miracle makers were if there weren't stable laws otherwise? I mean, if there were no miracles, you wouldn't know who the divine people were. In order for there to be miracles, there have to be a deviation from physical norms, which God has produced. So they looked deep into the mind of God looking for these physical laws. Now, the problem was, as the physical laws, as universalism in morals led to a better society, which led to universalism in physics, universalism in physics ended up taking away our belief in miracles, because every time the universal laws got pushed back, belief in miracles declined to the point where it's something that I read when I was quite young. The age of miracles is over. And as science has expanded throughout the universe, miracles become, well, just a little bit harder and harder to come by in any truly reliable fashion. So, universals in morals lead to universals in physics. Universals in physics lead to skepticism in miracles. Skepticism in miracles leads to a disbelief in morality, because morality is sanctioned by miracles. Jesus was known as the Son of God because of the wide variety of miracles he performed. Not like Smokey Robinson, who performed with the miracles. He simply performed miracles. It's a whole different kettle of theology. So, universal morals lead to universalism in physics, leads to science, leads to skepticism of miracles, but skepticism of miracles means atheism. Atheism means no belief in the universality of morals. Boom! University of morals leads to its own self-destruction. That's why we need philosophy. I just wanted to put that out there as a tiny little summation of something I was chatting about with my daughter today, because she was asking how many Christians believe that the Word of God is literal in the Bible and how many believe it's allegorical or metaphorical. So, yeah, there's your taste. It blew my mind when we were talking about it. And I thought I would, you know, an idea can suck and blow at the same time. This does both. It's an inhalation and an exhalation and a standing up and spitting in the sink. So that's my wee little intro to get the show off on a kicker. Perhaps you, my friends, would like to return the favor by giving me a juicy, deep, powerful, or deeply personal topic to discuss. Oh, I will mention, I got an email from someone who put, I think, a five-part video series together criticizing the metaphysics debate that I had. What was it last week? With the oddly aggressive foreign-born person. Danish? Danish, I guess. Now I want a Danish. Anyway, so he sent me an email, and I assumed it was all about critiquing my metaphysics, right? Objective reality doesn't exist. Other people don't exist. You can't prove anything. It's like, okay, well, why are you sending me an email? Boy, people get mad when you cut through the sophistry and just point out the blind, blank, empirical evidence of what they themselves are actually doing. Boy, people just get mad. Because the empiricism is the opposite of sophistry. Empiricism is beautiful. The empiricism of someone's actions completely blows apart the sophistry of their language. I mean, the guy who I had the debate with got mad because I was yelling, not at him, but about the argument, where he's saying, well, how, where is objective reality? What is it? And I said, it's where you get your food from. It's where you get your food from. And he got kind of upset about that. You're yelling and so on. It's like, how do you know? How do you know I exist? How do you know yelling is bad? How do you know I am yelling? How do you know your senses work, right? But he was real certain about how bad that was for me to raise my voice, even though he didn't believe in reality that much. So, yeah, people do just get kind of mad about this kind of stuff. But you say, well, based on you sending me an email, of course you believe in the senses, you believe in objective reality, you believe in self and other, and you believe that there are logical, rational standards that everybody has to comply with and conform with, and I deviated from them. You just point that stuff out. People get really mad. Now, I think it's a healthy kind of anger. It's a healthy kind of anger. Like, if you get a counterfeit detection machine, the people who make counterfeit bills, I mean, assuming that they won't all counterfeit these days, but the people who make counterfeit bills are going to get really mad at you, but it's a healthy kind of anger because they should stop stealing from everyone and they should go do something productive. But they don't, right? So because we keep enabling them. So it's a healthy kind of anger. You know, sophistry is so productive. Sophistry is so powerful. Right? How do you take down a nuclear-armed power? Well, history will forever record how you take it down is with sophistry. The pen is mightier than sword. Magic users. And it's funny, this all goes way all the way back to Dungeons & Dragons. So in Dungeons & Dragons, to just simplify it quite considerably, there's a lot of truth in it, which is why I think the game remains popular. So in Dungeons & Dragons, you have a fighter and you have a wizard. They're called magic users, but anyway, wizard, right? A fighter and a wizard. I mean, there's clerics and paladins and all that, but let's just, a fighter and a wizard. Now, a fighter has a sword and a shield and armor and goes in and bashes stuff, and the wizard, he starts off with like a couple of spells, and they were so lame that they added these mini spells called cantrips. And I played a magic user once. Dear Lord, it's just about the most boring thing in the known universe, because you've got a whole three-hour adventure one night, and what do you get? Two spells! Ooh, two spells. Wow. Okay. Really boring. Really boring. It's even more boring than being a thief, because at least a thief can check for traps and disarm traps and sneak up and stab attacks and stuff like that. But being a wizard is really, really boring. And you're very much underpowered. You start off with 4 hit points, which is nothing, right? The damage can be 1 to 4, 1 to 6, 1 to 8, 1 to 12. So one hit and you're dead. And plus, you have no armor. You can't wear armor because you need the physical dexterity to cast your spells, right? So in Dungeons & Dragons, as a wizard, you start off super boring. You know, like you literally, over a three-hour adventure, at least when I was playing, ooh, I'm going to cast my magic missile and detect invisibility or detect magic, and like that's it. That's all you got. Whereas the fighters are in there, you know, bash, 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 like lawnmowers, just going down through things. I remember fighting a whole bunch of kobolds, which are like really weak creatures, and like just the fight just went, it's like you get a hand cramp from rolling so much. It's like having a bad hand in Uno or being a teenage boy. So wizards start off really lame, really boring, but boy gosh, my boy, as a wizard, when you start getting higher up in levels and higher up in power, see, the power of the fighter goes up linear, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, it goes up. But the power of the wizard goes up exponentially. Now, this is true in life. You think of the tough guys, the sports athletes, the tough guys in high school. Well, you know, some of them go into the military and they get really well trained and learn how to fight and all that, and it's really cool and powerful. Whereas the nerds and the wizards and so on, they're just working with language and computer code or propaganda or whatever it is, convincing people. And so the jocks start off strong, the nerds start off weak. But later on, the jocks are in a woke military where they have to take a vaccine, and the nerds are running the Department of Education and indoctrinating everyone. So yeah, it's just kind of true that the language people start off super weak, but end up, in conjunction with the state, with the power of the state, they end up super strong. So I remember that first night at my friend's place. First night I played Dungeons and Dragons. The orc was the pig-faced humanoid, and I saw it so vividly in my mind's eye, it was creepy. We were playing Caves of Chaos, and we came across an orc encampment, and we decided to encircle and attack them. And it squealed, and oh, man, so vivid. I don't know if that's true for everyone, but man, it came alive in my brain in truly fantastical ways. All right, so this is your show, my friends. I am super happy to hear from you. So if you have thoughts, comments, questions, issues, disagreements, criticisms, fashion suggestions, home decor suggestions, whatever is on your gorgeous listener mind, I am super happy to hear from you. Just, I think you've got to do a request to speak, and I can unmute you, and there you go. Bob's your uncle, as they used to say. Let me just check here. Ah, yes. We do have someone. Monsieur le Adam. It's of course, Adam gets to go first alphabetically in the Bible and in this show. You have to unmute, and I'm all yours, brother.
Hello, can you hear me?
Go for it.
Hi. I wanted to talk to you about something I was reading today and just thinking about. I started a new book. It's called Kalima Tales by Varlam Shalimov. He's considered the counterpart to Solzhenitsyn in documenting what happened in the Soviet gulags. And Solzhenitsyn in the Gulag Archipelago said in probably the best chapter, where he's really talking about the, it's called The Soul and the Barbed Wire. He really talks about the effect of camp and prison on people more than just describing things. And in that chapter, he talked about how him and Shalimov agree on almost everything except one point, which was that in camp, in these virtually, you know, Auschwitz-type winter death camps, that people are corrupted by the environment, just irreversibly. It's such a horrible, brutal environment where the thief class, the camp guards, all types of immoral people tend to acquire the resources and survive, while the people who want to stick to their conscience and to be moral tend to die off. And so you're forced to corrupt yourself in order to survive in a situation like this. And both of them agreed on that to an extent. Shalimov more so. Solzhenitsyn said that people who became corrupted in camp or in prison, but more in camp, were already corrupted